Good morning, Bradley Levine, registration number 13095 on behalf of the appellant. May it please the court. The district court abused its discretion in ordering a remittitor or a new trial following the verdict in the first trial in this case. The case was tried to a jury that was properly instructed. After hearing the evidence, the jury awarded the plaintiff damages in three separate categories: economic damages, non-economic damages, and for physical impairment. Under federal law in the state of Colorado, if there is some evidence sustaining that verdict, it must be upheld. The trial court cannot substitute its view for that of the jury, but that's exactly what the court did here in ruling on the motion for new trial. I think it's very important for the court to look at the substance of that order, because the court erred in some very significant respects. What the court did is that after, again, reviewing the record, the transcript was available to the court said that the evidence adduced at the trial regarding plaintiff's injury included the following. And if you look at the summary of what it is that the plaintiff's testimony was, the court just simply selected some aspects of the testimony that was given up till the time it says the last day of her treatment was January 28, 2010. And I'm not going to go through and recite exactly the few sentences that are included there. But what's significant is the court completely ignored Ms. Farrar's testimony with respect to the ongoing unremitting pain that she had up until the time of trial. She testified about the fact that she had this ongoing pain because of her back, that it never ceased. She talked about the difficulties she had getting up in the morning, the problems that she had doing any kind of housework, the problems that she had in just simply, you know, coping with things day to day, the fact that she had to take medications, the fact that she had acupuncture. She testified that she had pain, ongoing pain, on a scale of 6 to 7 out of 1 out of 10. That was the testimony that the court made absolutely no mention of when the court talked about the plaintiff's testimony. The court proceeded to talk about Dr. Ramos's testimony. And what the court did is that it went through and it looked at, it cited some aspects from some medical records that were done. Dr. Ramos treated the patient, treated Ms. Farrar for about 6 to 8 months after the incident, but found that he basically released her knowing that she was going to have ongoing problems because of thoracic facet injury, which she testified to about the trial. And yet the court proceeded to say, despite Dr. Ramos's conclusory statement that thoracic facet syndrome is something plaintiff would live with for the rest of her life, and then goes on and says, according to the last treatment records, so goes back to treatment records that were maybe, you know, 2.5 years prior to the trial, and said that looking at those prior treatment records, he seemed to basically say that everything was going to be all right with her. What was completely ignored in any of the recitation of the testimony was Dr. Ramos's clear, unequivocal testimony that Ms. Farrar had a thoracic facet injury, that it was evident on an MRI, that you could see from the disc narrowing that this was going to be a problem, that it was something she was going to have to deal with for the rest of her life, that it was a permanent problem. What the court did is it says, plaintiff did not introduce any more recent evidence supporting the existence of a permanent thoracic spine injury. And a review of the record tells you that is absolutely not true. Dr. Ramos was absolutely clear in his testimony before the jury. And the court proceeds to conclude that there was no evidence which supported the jury's award of $414,640 of damages for physical impairment. And once again, that's not true. There was ample evidence in the record to support the jury's determination that in fact there was physical impairment and that it was going to be a permanent problem for Ms. Farrar.
Mr. Levine, did the fact that the jury instructions didn't provide any definition for physical impairment factor into the court's order?
Well, the court noted that there was no definition of physical impairment. And the fact is that under the statute, we don't have a definition. And Your Honor, if I can, I'm going to advise the court. I serve on the Colorado Supreme Court Jury Instruction Committee, and this is something that we have actually dealt with for the last several years. In fact, quite frankly, I've urged the Instruction Committee to try to come up with a definition for physical impairment, because it doesn't exist. We know that it's there in the area of workers' compensation and so on, but there isn't any kind of definition. And quite frankly, the Jury Instruction Committee has decided that we're not going to do anything about it because we don't have an appellate authority that defines it. Okay? I would like to take the opportunity, if I can, to suggest a possible, if the court goes that far, feels that we need to have some kind of definition of the law to advance what I think would be an appropriate definition based upon the law. If you look at the Valdez case, where the court made it clear that we're talking about a permanent type of problem that affects someone's ability to be able to carry on their lives, if you will. It affects them bodily, that might impair their ability both for soundness of mind or for soundness of body.
Well, let me stop here. Okay. So is it, in these, I'm not suggesting they're mutually exclusive, but is the physical impairment here the permanence of this thoracic facet injury?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it ongoing pain through the trial date, or is it both?
It's both. I mean, the pain is the manifestation of the ongoing problem.
But isn't that separately compensable?
Well, but again, what the courts have talked about, if we look at Preston versus DuPont versus Preston, you look at the Kramer versus Valdez case and the authorities that they cite there, what you have is, and what the courts have talked about is that you have, that we know we've got economic damages, okay, that's some, that is an area of recompense because if someone has injuries and, yeah. There's the examples of the football player who has a leg amputation can't play football anymore, obviously, that's going to be compensated as far as economic damages. If we have non-economic damages, which I think Your Honor is talking about, we have a category of pain and suffering, essentially what the statute talks about with respect to various areas of non-economic damage. But what the legislature also said is that, and this is consistent with the treatise authorities and the courts have said, is that if you have a permanent problem that is going to affect your ability to be able to have, that wholeness, that capacity, function for presumably for the rest of your life, in other words, the permanent problem, that is going to be a separate area for compensation. In fact, if we look at the legislative history, what the court is talking about is instances if someone is laid up in bed, if they're going to, if because of an accident, they're going to be housebound, they're going to be bedbound for the rest of their lives, that's something which should be compensated for separately from those areas.
Okay, here's what I was trying to get to, and probably not very artfully.
Sure.
If we agree with you that there is a basis in the record that would trigger an award in the physical impairment category,
yes.
How can we say that the lower court abused its discretion in concluding that the $414,000 was simply so excessive that new trial or remittiture was required? Not that we would necessarily agree or be comfortable with that, but how is that an abuse of discretion?
It's an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, because what's happened here, there is any evidence, I mean, the case law is clear, if there's any evidence whatsoever to sustain the verdict, then the court doesn't have the ability to walk in there and say, well, I don't think that this award can be sustained because I don't think there was any evidence, and therefore what the court did here is take that physical impairment award and take it down to zero. Okay?
So you're reading the judge as saying that there was no evidence of physical impairment as opposed to saying that the amount awarded was simply excessive.
That's correct. I mean, first of all, remember, the court didn't say that there was any kind of bias or prejudice that would warrant a new trial. Okay? So the court said there was no evidence. It's right here on page 9 of the court's order. There was no evidence which supported the jury's award of, and he gives the dollar amount, of damages for physical impairment, and dropped it down to zero. So, yes, Your Honor, I think that's exactly, and I think it's the only way that you can read what's happened here, is the court found that there was no evidence whatsoever to sustain that determination.
Well, okay, but if and you obviously know the details better than at least I do, but I mean, if there's no evidence, if that's the way you're reading the judge's ruling, then how can he grant the remitter opportunity?
Because what he did is he took the fiscal impairment down to zero, but there was $22,500 that was awarded for the economic damages and $50,000 in non-economic.
So that's damages. That was the remitter.
So
that's the math on the remitter.
That's what the court did. Is that the court zeroed out the fiscal impairment and the remitter amount was $72,000. I'd like to advance this, and then we can go on. But let me just give you a potential definition if the court needs to go there as far as a definition for fiscal impairment. And now I would suggest that it involves permanent loss or diminishment of function or capacity that makes a person less than physically or mentally whole. And I believe that that's consistent with the law, certainly with, again, to suggest somehow, for example, that the Valdez case didn't require any kind of permanence is not true. And the Supreme Court said that physical impairment, that disfigurement, constitutes a permanent injury irrespective of any pain or inconvenience. That's why we have this third category, if you will. The tortfeasor caused the victim to have a permanent injury that she did not have before. And that describes exactly what the circumstance was for Ms. Farrar, that she was fine, she was 18 years old, and because of this, immediately, she had pain in her back and other parts of her body, and it continued, and that was the only evidence that there is there, that it was a continual problem right up until the time of trial.
Mr. Levine?
Yes, John.
It looks like another possible way that the trial court came out was that it was concerned because there was no instruction on physical impairment, as you've indicated. There's been no guidance yet from the jury instruction committee. And it believed that the per diem part of the closing argument confused the jury and led them to believe that they were awarding a non-economic damages category of pain and suffering into the physical impairment. Can you address why that would be an abuse of discretion?
Yes, because the upshot is we know closing argument's not evidence. And we also know that the jury was instructed pursuant to the law and the instructions in the state that the jury's not supposed to consider the closing argument as evidence. And so the upshot of it is that, under the Armentrout case, we know that a jury is presumed to follow the court instructions. So the upshot is that whatever kind of speculation as to how it is that the jury arrived at their numbers, I mean, we can't have courts doing that. We can't have courts saying, here's what they did. They did a per diem, and of course, the number that the jury came up with really wasn't the number that was being suggested by counsel. But in any event, you can't look at what the jury did in their determination and say, okay, here's the closing argument, and I think, therefore, that the jury is basically awarding for pain and suffering rather than the physical impairment. That's not a place of a court to be doing that, and certainly not based upon a closing argument, which is not evidence. If I can, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm John Ledsack, and I represent the appellee, Denise Smith. There was no abuse of discretion by the trial court in deciding that this award, this amount of $414,000, was manifestly excessive. This is not a ruling where the court held that there was no basis to award anything in that category. It was not a JNOV, obviously. It was a order for a new trial under the section of Rule 59, which gives the trial court authority to set aside verdicts because the damages are either manifestly excessive or manifestly inadequate. So the court decided that based on this evidence, $414,000 was an unreasonable amount for the category of physical impairment. Now, an indication of how far off base that amount is reflected in the fact of what happened at the second trial, which is based on virtually the same evidence. Another jury came to the conclusion that $50,000 was actually the proper award for damages in the category of physical impairment, and no one has challenged that verdict. So what are the parameters that are to be considered in deciding whether an award is excessive? So the parties you pointed out, the Walmart case that the Supreme Court decided in 2011, that case points out that the trial court has power under the rule, as I said. It's left to the sole discretion of the trial judge, whose presence and observation at the trial better equip him or her to make that determination. Then they go on to say that the amount of damages is within the sole province of the jury and it won't be disturbed unless it's completely unsupported by the record. Finally, the reasonableness of an award is always subject to judicial scrutiny in the post-trial and appellate stages of the case. So what evidence is the plaintiff pointing to here as support for this award of $414,000 of physical impairment? They point to evidence of pain. Pain is specifically in the statutory definition of another category of damages, non-economic damages. And the legislature in 1986 enacted a statute for the purpose of imposing caps on certain recoveries in personal injury cases. And the portion that is capped is the portion that falls within the definition of non-economic damages. And I know the court is aware of what the definition reads, but let me just emphasize the portion that is significant for this case. Non-economic loss or injury means non-pecuniary harm for which damages are recoverable. And the statute, they distinguish that from economic damages. So that's the two-part dichotomy there. Damages are non-economic or they're economic. And the legislature lists a non-exclusive number of factors that constitute non-economic loss. They say, including, they don't say, and that shall consist of, it says, non-economic loss is non-pecuniary harm, including pain and suffering, inconvenience, emotional distress, and impairment of the quality of life. So much, if not all, of what the plaintiff is talking about as evidence that was improperly not considered falls within that definition of non-economic loss or injury, pain and suffering, emotional distress, or impairment of quality of life.
Then what is physical impairment? If you're suggesting that all of Mr. Levine's arguments are really non-economic injury, then what's physical impairment?
Physical impairment is, there are cases that define it. It is the term itself can be interpreted, physical impairment. It is an impairment and it has to be physical. The jury instruction, unfortunately, does not specify or elaborate on that, but there is case law that defines what that is. So as this jury was instructed, it didn't get any more details on what physical impairment is, but if we go back into the evidence to decide, okay, what is physical impairment?
I apologize if I asked a poor question. My question wasn't, what is the evidence? That's going to be question two. I mean, what's your definition of physical impairment that would then not be swept up by non-economic injury?
This is a section that we discussed in the brief, and our position is that physical impairment is defined in cases as I don't have a pre-written definition like Mr. Levine had, but I would suggest that these are the factors to be considered. Concrete effects that have observable limitations. The older cases that we cited in the brief, the Barter case that are pre-1986, the legislature presumably was aware of terms and can be presumed that, you know, those concepts are still valid. Those cases talk about things that are patent as opposed to, you know, non-observable. So in this case, let's take it to what this case is. If there was some impact of these injuries on the functions of daily life, that could be a physical impairment.
But if it isn't also impairment of quality of life?
It can be, and that's where there's a blurring. For example, if you cannot do some of your favorite activities because of an injury. That's impairment of quality of life. So it's, getting back to Judge Case Bull's opinion, and you used the analogy of the football player. And so a lawyer who has an amputated leg is not going to have much economic injury, but if that lawyer happens to love playing tennis, then that's an impairment of quality of life. So the physical impairment, the fact that you can't use the leg anymore, it's different for different people, but there can be economic consequences. There can also be impairment of quality of life. But what we're looking at here is an observable functional limitation on the person's, the body, the integrity of the body as a working unit, that is impaired because of the injuries. And what this court found, what the trial court found, was that if you look at what the evidence of that was, it just doesn't support an award of the magnitude of $414,000.
Well, let me ask you this. If we were to conclude that the plaintiff put on some evidence of physical impairment, are we to defer to the jury at that point for the amount?
That gets into an area that I have tried to fine-tune what the review is. And let me just start with, I'll answer your question by pointing a situation that is different, and that is economic damages. So if you look at something like economic damages, and the evidence is that they lost income of $20,000. That's the only evidence. And the jury came back with $100,000. Well, there you can clearly say there's no evidence to support $20,000. What we're talking about here are the non-pecuniary areas of damage. So this is something where there aren't hard and fast rules. I mean, the jury does its best. The court has to do its best in reviewing that. So it's not like, okay, we can look at this formula and we come up with this. It is an overall assessment of the reasonableness of that award given what the evidence is. So I suggest the appropriate way to analyze this is you look at the proof of various elements of what the injury is, such as there's evidence of the facet syndrome. Well, what specifically was there evidence of the effect of that on impairment of physical activities? None. There was lots of testimony about pain. So you look at those facts that were proved in the area of damages, and if there is evidence in the record to support the establishment of those facts, then you have to accept those. But what dollar amount is reasonable based on that is not something where you just have to defer to the jury, because otherwise, what's the reason for the existence of this rule at all? I mean, you don't defer to the jury on calculating the amount. You have to look at the evidence that they based it on and inferences from that evidence, but it doesn't necessarily tie into, you have to, accept their dollar.
Okay, let me try to, okay, so do you agree that there was evidence in the record from on which the jury could have awarded something for physical impairment?
Yes.
Okay, so we're just talking they awarded too much.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
And that is what the trial court did. We're not saying that it was error to give an instruction on physical impairment now. I mean, we objected to it, to the instruction. This is not a case where, we're saying that it's improper at all to give any award for physical impairment. We're just saying that given the testimony from Ms. Ferrer, and the only other testimony on damages was from Dr. Ramos, you look at there and you separate out pain, you separate out impairment of quality of life, because that's a separate category, and you just look at what was the physical impairment of her as a result of these injuries, and there is some. I mean, she said that she couldn't do housework for 2 months. And so, that is there some quantum of evidence that would support the damages in that category? Giving her the benefit of the inferences, yes. But, I mean, if you look at, let me just cite back to the Walmart case, the Supreme Court case in 2011. These are the things that the opinion talked about in the list of physical impairments. So as you recall, in that case, there were awards in three different categories, and the court analyzed what the evidence was and said, here's what it is, and we don't think this was excessive. So in the category of non-economic damages, I'm sorry, in the category of physical impairment, let me be clear about this, this is the physical impairment part. The list was difficulty walking, falls often, bladder and bowel incontinence, cannot work in any kind of job, trouble performing simple everyday tasks such as cooking, carrying groceries, cleaning, basic hygiene. And that's in the Averitt versus Walmart at 463. So if you look at that list, the only thing that is satisfied here, or the only thing that appears on that same list as physical impairment, is the housework, which was limited for a couple of months. Now, if you look at what the Supreme Court talked about in the Walmart case as to the non-economic part, this was the list. Chronic pain, causing personality changes, depression, difficulty sleeping, difficulty concentrating, looks tired, run down, emotional, and she cried. And that is also in the Averitt opinion at 463. That list of non-economic damages is almost exactly what the evidence was for Ms. Ferrer in this case. Headaches, neck pain, back pain, shoulder pain, arm pain, hip pain, depression, complaints of constant pain. So what the list in the Walmart case, the two lists of physical impairment damages, what evidence there was to support that, the list of what evidence of non-economic damages to support that, shows that in this case, all the damages that the plaintiff is saying was an error to ignore goes into the category of non-economic damages. So if you just look at what the evidence was to support the physical impairment, $414,000 was manifestly excessive. One final comment, and that is to try to separate this concept of permanent injury from any of the statutory categories. The plaintiff appears to argue that permanent injury somehow necessarily means there's physical impairment. So if you establish any injury that is permanent, that automatically you've established a physical impairment.
Why is that wrong?
Because I don't think that every injury creates a physical impairment. So there are injuries that are temporary, there are injuries that are permanent. Not every injury causes a physical impairment.
All right, but if that's your argument, then doesn't the person who suffers a permanent, albeit non-impairing injury, walk out of the courtroom uncompensated for the permanency of the injury to their body?
No.
Well, then what are they compensated?
They are compensated in the category of non-economic damages for life. So if there's an injury that somebody offers testimony that will cause pain and suffering for life. It will cause inconvenience.
Oh, okay, but I think you're assuming away the question. Suppose I have a permanent injury that causes me no pain, no loss of recreational activities, no loss of vocational opportunity. Under your view, don't I go out uncompensated for the permanence of the injury to my body?
If I
can't trigger these other categories?
If you have a permanent injury, let's just say, look, to make it concrete, it's a disfigurement. You have a scar. Doesn't cause any impairment, doesn't cause any pain. You don't get anything for pain and suffering, you don't get anything for physical impairment. It's permanent. So not every permanent injury results in physical impairment.
So you're in a sense using physical impairment almost as an exclusory concept, as well as an inclusory.
Well, it is an exclusory because the legislature says don't put it in with non-economic damages because those are capped. So if you're going to consider physical impairment, award them separately because we're not going to cap those. So it is important to keep those three categories separate And I suggest that in all of those categories, you can have injuries that are temporary and deserve compensation, and you have injuries that are permanent and deserve compensation. But the mere fact that you've established permanent injury in one category doesn't mean that you get anything in another category.
But did you get anything just for the permanence of the injury without regard to any of these other categories?
If you just put it into the slot, if you can find some damages in a slot, you get that award.
And if you can't, you don't, even though your body's permanently injured.
Well, I see, if you permanently injured, I mean, I just have to go back to the scar situation, Your Honor. There can be injuries that don't...
Well, let me give you one that's maybe easier. Suppose due to somebody else's negligence, I rip my knee up. The doctor says, I repaired it. Today, you can run out of the operating room if you want, but your knee's going to fall apart in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, well within your normal life expectancy. Isn't that a permanent injury for which I should be compensated, even though it has no present consequences in pain, there's no present consequences in loss of enjoyment of life or anything else?
Yes, that is a permanent injury. Because what you can factor in, and courts do, and juries do this all the time, is it something hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
My time is up, man. I'll answer your question.
Sure.
Something may happen in the future. There is a 20% chance that you're going to need another surgery to fix your knee.
But you're moving it back into these other categories.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough said.
Thank you. We ask the court to affirm.
Unless I missed something as far as Mr. Lebsack's presentation, I thought I heard him concede that there was some physical impairment. And if there was evidence of a physical impairment, that means that what the trial court did here was abuse its discretion in remitting that amount to zero. And this court doesn't have the ability to be able to go back and say, well, the number should have been something else lower, which is what I heard Mr. Lebsack to suggest to this court. What this court is constrained to do is to find that if there is some evidence in the record establishing that there's a physical impairment, to find that in fact the court did use its discretion in ordering the remittiture that it did and reinstate the jury verdict on the first trial, which is what we've asked to be done here. The idea here is that we have to have, in order for there to be physical impairment, there has to be some kind of observable physical limitation, some functional limitation. It's just not so. For example, no one would disagree that if someone's blind, if they had a nerve injury, if they had a brain injury, that may be something physical and would be a functional limitation, but it may not be observable to somebody looking at it. So it doesn't have to be observable, as Mr. Lebsack has suggested. The other thing is that we're not just talking about pain. I think Mr. Lebsack acknowledged that if you go through, and of course, every case is to be considered on its merits. And if you look at the Walmart case, yes, there's a litany, there's a description of the various limitations that the plaintiff in that case had. In our case, same thing. It's not just pain. She testified about the fact that she had problems getting up in the morning, that she had problems just doing ordinary housework, that she had problems in terms of her ability to simply cook and wash and do those kinds of things. Those are physical limitations that go beyond just simply pain. Obviously, pain was a huge aspect of it, but it certainly restricted her daily activities, and that is physical impairment.
Let me ask you this. Yeah. This just sort of occurred to me as I was listening to you, so I have given it a no thought. So you sort of put it in the, we don't have the ability as an appellate court to reduce, and as you say, right now it stands at zero. Do we have the authority to order yet a new trial on damages if we were to disagree?
No, Your Honor. I mean, a third trial, and I was just thinking about that when I heard Mr. Webster. I don't think you have the ability to be able to send us back for a third trial, because what you have to do is you have to give the jury, okay, the fact that, you know, we're not going to question what juries did. And if there's some evidence in the record, again, if we look at all the authorities, it says if there's some evidence in the record to sustain what the jury did, we can't have reviewing courts say, well, you know, maybe I think that the number shouldn't have been 414,000, but maybe it should have been 200,000 or 50,000 or whatever it may be. This reviewing court doesn't have the ability to be able to do that and have whatever kind of suspicions or concerns, maybe it was too high and so on. Remember, the court already found that there was no passion or prejudice that infected this jury determination. The court just simply found that it was manifestly excessive on the basis that the court found, and if you look at the order, it's very clear, there was no evidence whatsoever. And if there is evidence in the record, that determination is wrong, and I don't think this court has any other choice under these circumstances but to affirm that determination, in other words, to remand this case for entry of judgment on the first jury verdict.
So this case is, if not unique, different because on the one hand, the judge's remittiture allows for nothing in physical impairment, but apart from what Mr. Lepsak may or may not have conceded, in your view, the record contains some evidence of physical impairment.
Absolutely.
So if the judge's remittiture had given $20,000 or $40,000 or $60,000 for physical impairment, it would be a different case than the one you're arguing.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, we understand, and certainly the Walmart case talks about that. The judge can sit there and look at the evidence, and the courts do that, not all the time, but they'll do that. That's part of the remittiture process, where the court thinks that it was manifestly excessive. So what the court does is say, you know, I heard the evidence, I think that $1 million, there's no evidence to sustain that, so it should be $500,000, okay?
I understand.
The court will do that. Exactly, Your Honor. But the point here is the court found that there was no evidence whatsoever, and that was not true. And we can't have a reviewing court saying, well, now your remittiture amount to zero is wrong, so go try it again.
I understand.
Thank you.
Well, we appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.